Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is hoping New Jersey voters don't count him out in the state's primary election next month. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Hundreds showed their support today at a rally in Atlantic City, where Sanders used the city's financial troubles to rail against corporate greed and take more than one shot at Donald Trump. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
The backdrop of Atlantic City's crumbling casino industry was too much for Bernie Sanders to resist as he launched into his stump speech on income inequality and corporate greed.
The greed and the recklessness that we have seen from people like Donald Trump and Carl Icahn. Oh, you know Donald Trump.
For years, Trump owned several casinos in Atlantic City, but he does not anymore. One was the now-closed Trump Plaza, which sat just a few steps from the rally in Boardwalk Hall. Another speaker, Atlantic City Councilman Mo Delgado, used its fate to criticize Trump.
Well, let's talk Trump. Right outside these doorways, you had one of his wonderful monikers he likes to talk about here, how he built Atlantic City, right next door. Trump Plaza. The big question I keep saying is, how's it working for you, right?
The other guy Sanders mentioned, billionaire investor Carl Icahn, owns two Atlantic City casinos and recently cut workers' health and pension benefits at one of them. Casino Workers Union President Bob McDevitt, who also spoke at the rally, says Atlantic City casino employees have sacrificed enough.
And I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm tired. I'm tired of hearing we don't have the money to educate our children. I'm tired to hear that health care is something no one has a right to, but has to have the money to pay for.
In his speech, Sanders also called for universal health care, a $15 federal minimum wage, and free tuition at public colleges and universities. He'll face Hillary Clinton in New Jersey's primary on June 7th. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
A federal judge has ordered the Franklin Institute to stop discriminating against disabled patrons by charging personal care attendants entrance fees. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the court order follows a 2013 lawsuit claiming that the nonprofit museum's policies prevented some disabled people from enjoying all the Institute has to offer.
It all started when a man with cerebral palsy who uses an electric wheelchair to get around was told his caretaker had to also pay to get in. The Franklin Institute says giving personal care attendants a free pass could eventually lead to a deficit, even layoffs down the road. A U.S. district judge in Philadelphia called that illogical, since the Institute couldn't even say how much money it might lose. The judge says he was, quote, frankly puzzled that the nonprofit fought the case for more than 2 years. Attorney Stephen Gold represented the man with cerebral palsy and sued the Institute for violating the Americans with Disabilities Act.
By him winning, other people with severe disabilities who require personal care attendance so that they can enjoy the Franklin Institute the way non-disabled people can enjoy it.
The museum says from now on, it'll waive caretaker fees, even for IMAX screenings and other special exhibits. They also say they have a long history of serving the disabled community through outreach and education programs. The Institute wouldn't say whether it definitely plans to appeal the court order, but said they're exploring all their options. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
More than 1 week after a natural gas pipeline exploded around 30 miles east of Pittsburgh, investigators are still looking for clues as to what caused it. The explosion sent one man to the hospital and destroyed his home, damaging several others. Reed Frazier went to the site of the explosion and found that it's fanning the flames of the already smoldering debate over building more pipelines in Pennsylvania.
A tornado, a huge storm, an airplane crashing. That's how neighbors describe the sound of the explosion that took place at 8:13 a.m. on April 29th in a field in Westmoreland County.
But the noise was so loud and it was sickening, the rushing noise from the oxygen coming in, and it consumed all the oxygen around here. It had double the time breathing.
Dave Allen has lived down the road from where the blast occurred for the last 7 years. He says the explosion doesn't make him worry about the potential for other mishaps with pipelines in the area.
They're constantly putting in pipelines, and they're relatively safe. There's a lot worse things to be worried about than gas explosions, believe me.
Investigators released a preliminary report that said corrosion along a weld in the 30-inch pipeline may have caused the blast. The pipeline is part of the Texas Eastern Transmission Line, a 9,000-mile system of pipes that transports natural gas north from the Gulf Coast to the eastern seaboard. Brigham McCown used to head up the federal agency in charge of pipeline safety.
Pipelines really are like underground energy highways. Some of them are interstates. Some of them are rural country roads.
And the Texas Eastern Pipeline is like an interstate highway. McCown says 2.6 million miles of pipelines around the country carry oil and gas every day, almost always without incident.
There is no exact science, though. There's a level of risk that we all take in our daily lives, and it's about managing that risk. To the extent that pipelines aren't used, then other forms of transportation are used that are, frankly, far more dangerous.
But accidents do occur. Over the past decade, there have been more than 300 serious incidents involving pipelines, resulting in 132 deaths. And these can often take place close to where people live. In fact, there's no minimal setback for pipelines from homes and buildings established by the federal government. Rebecca Craven is with the watchdog Pipeline Safety Trust.
There are situations where new pipelines are going through, and even with the ability to move away from a house or a group of houses, they are choosing to run a straight line and go close to those houses simply because it's cheaper.
The explosion in western Pennsylvania took place 200 yards behind a house. A man in the house, identified as 26-year-old James Baker, fled the home just before it was engulfed in flames. He suffered third-degree burns on three-quarters of his body and was picked up by a neighbor who'd driven by in his truck. The explosion was heard 2 miles away by Dean Law. He initially thought it was a nearby compressor station letting gas out of its pipes.
And then it kept going for about 10 minutes. I said, that doesn't sound right to me.
For the last 2.5 years, Law had been fighting a pipeline company, Sunoco Logistics, about putting a pipeline on his property. He finally agreed to accept the company's offer this year after Sunoco threatened to use eminent domain. But he's not happy about it. Among his main concerns is that the pipeline cuts through a mobile home park he built on his property and will pass a few feet from the houses of his tenants. One of those is his own daughter, Dawn Law.
You can see where they've taken the other property owner's trees out up to our property line. So this is how much more's got to come out of here.
They show me the right-of-way, which follows an older pipeline that was built in the 1930s on the land. The new pipeline will go right by Dawn's front door. And the recent explosion has her worried about her own safety in the unlikely event of a similar explosion.
Living this close to it, what chance do you have? You don't have a chance.
If you're there, you're gone, that's all.
Dean Law doubts that'll ever happen on his property. But he says the more pipelines there are, the more chances there can be for another explosion. And with the current drilling boom, he sees more pipelines in the future. I'm Reed Frazier.
Still ahead, it's sometimes called the talk, that conversation that parents of African-American boys have about talking to police.
I was trying to figure out how to have this conversation with my son. But it turned out to be bigger than that. It turned out to be healing for a lot of people, as well as myself.
Photographer Denise Allen puts the talk into pictures when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Documentary photographer Denise Allen trains her lens on subjects to shed light on often misunderstood aspects of American society. That priority is in evidence in an exhibit of her work entitled My Son Matters. Denise, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
I went to your website, and perhaps more accurately, it's listing you as an art and social change photographer. Explain.
Well, the way the whole thing started, I started out doing fashion 30 years ago. I worked in New York as well as in Chicago, and I was in New York at a time when AIDS broke out. And when AIDS broke out, I lost a lot of friends, and I felt like I didn't know what to do. I felt like I needed to be more, have a life that's more meaningful. Went back to school and became a teacher.
And that's when you came down to the Philadelphia region.
Exactly. That's when I came back to Philadelphia region. And it wasn't until really the death of Trayvon Martin that to me was another epidemic. Just like AIDS, another group of people were being killed. However, this was young black males. And I felt like I needed to do something. Then I realized I had a voice. My voice was my camera.
And so specifically this exhibit, which is now, I believe it's going to be its ninth showing, coming up in May. How did you choose your subjects and how many pieces are in the exhibit?
There's 16 pieces in the exhibit. I started off with myself and a couple of friends. And then after that, good old Facebook, I put it out and got about 20 people called in a matter of 2 days. I didn't know. And we automatically bonded. The whole experience, I would start off with basically two strangers in my house, but when they left, we were very close. They were just happy to have their story told. So even though I sort of did it, I call it my little therapy, because I was trying to figure out how to have this conversation with my son. But it turned out to be bigger than that. It turned out to be healing for a lot of people, as well as myself.
Now, which conversation with your son?
The conversation, My Son Matters, is a photography exhibit that documents the conversations that, I said single mothers because I am, but every mother has to have with their child to make sure they make it home safe at night. After Trayvon Martin and so many more have died, I realize I'm a single mom that I have to have these conversations with my son. My son's adopted. I adopted him on my own, so there's no father figure here. So I realize, okay, even though I'm making decisions as far as what school he should go to, what neighborhoods we should live in, I need to take this a step further and let him know that even though I tell him to walk around and be proud of himself and be polite and put your chest up and be, you know, look someone in the eye, when he gets stopped by the police, he needs to humble himself some. He needs to speak, you know, speak slower. He needs to be aware that he's a threat to not only police officers, but to a lot of people.
For mothers and dads and kids who don't feel vulnerable, either because of their racial background or living circumstances, how do they see this exhibit?
They told me it was very interesting. They never thought about it. There were quite a few mothers that were Caucasian. They said, I never thought about it. And one of them even said, well, I understand what you're saying, because I tell my son that he needs to cut his hair and he needs to do things because people will look at him and they will think, wow, he's not as smart as he is or as intelligent or as trustworthy. But I told him the difference is he can cut his hair and he can be all right. If you're African-American, it doesn't make a difference. You cannot change your skin color.
Let's note that during, before, and since this epiphany about Trayvon Martin and the epidemic, you've been a teacher.
Yes, I've been a teacher for 26 years. I'm an art teacher in Cheltenham School District. And I love it. I really do. And that was also one of the reasons why I wanted to do this, because I looked at some of the kids there and I asked them, I said, when these murders were taking place, and I'm going to call them murders because that's exactly how I feel. I asked them, did your mother talk to you about it? You know, just one-on-one. Did they say anything? And a lot of them said a little something, or some said no. And I feel like this is a conversation that has to happen. And they're fifth and sixth grade. They're not too young.
Do you think that conversation, though, takes place among peers, among kids themselves?
It really takes place if it takes place at home first, because I don't even think they're aware of it. I did an exhibit first. My first exhibit was called By the Content of My Character. And this one was exactly right after Trayvon got killed. I photographed 23 young men. I put them in hoodies and put them in environments that best describe them and asked them about Trayvon Martin. Now, a lot of kids, and even my son, they 15, 14, some even a couple little younger. And I think they did it because their mother told them. So right now I'm in the process of re-interviewing these kids and said, okay, this happened 4 years ago. How do you see it now? What do you think about it now? Because I'm quite sure they have had a chance to experience racism and just really think about it.
The exhibit is called My Son Matters. Denise Allen, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
What astronomers are not seeing may prove more interesting in the detection of dark matter. Let's adjust our telescopes with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, I've got my telescope at the ready.
I'm glad you do, because this one really does make your head hurt, and it might make your eyes hurt too. Astronomers are beginning to use a particular kind of gravitational lensing effect caused by large, more proximate or closer galaxies to identify the existence of what they think are clumps of dark matter.
Lensing effect, like an optical lens?
Exactly like an optical lens. Einstein predicted in his general theory of relativity that more massive objects would be able to distort the light of more distant objects, just like happens with a lens. When a lens moves into our field of view, that lens distorts the appearance of objects that are at a distance. Now, this gravitational lensing effect creates what looks like a ring around the intervening galaxy that really is a distorted image of the more distant galaxy. And that ring of material is identified as an Einstein ring. And we can use this as a method of observing more distant galaxies.
Now, where does the dark matter come into play?
Well, here's where the dark matter comes into play. Using a telescope in Chile called the ALMA telescope, astronomers were observing the Einstein ring of a more distant galaxy, and they discovered a distortion in that otherwise typically smooth Einstein ring. What they determined is that that disturbance is probably caused by a clump of dark matter, an invisible clump of dark matter that is actually associated with the intervening galaxy that's being used as the gravitational lens. And astronomers are actually very much interested in tracking down more of these objects because they can't find all the mass. Something's missing somewhere. And so the idea of dark matter, matter of mass, not visible, might be making up the rest of the missing mass.
And that missing mass is actually, as an aggregate, much more than the non-missing mass.
Oh, yeah. This is the really perplexing part, or the really interesting part, if you will. You know, when we look at our entire galaxy, we find that 96% of the material in our universe is dark matter.
96%?
Yeah. And that leaves the 4% of the real stuff left over of everything we know of is what we would call the real matter, which in my mind tells me that there's some process that goes on here in the universe that is predominantly about the dark matter and not predominantly about the real matter.
Does the dark matter exist apart from the real matter? Or if I wave my hand, I'm slashing through dark matter as well?
This is a tough one to think about. We believe that the dark matter is distributed throughout the universe. And we can tell because of its influence on the expansion of the universe. We believe that huge clumps of dark matter occupy what look like vacuum spaces between strings and clusters of galaxies. And so the dark matter exists there and is pushing the rest of the universe apart. But that's a great question. I don't know if, holding out my hand, I hold just as much dark matter as I do real matter.
Let's go with what we know. What's available to be seen in the night sky this week?
Well, we're really fortunate because there's a lot of great stuff to be seen as the night goes on. Of course, Jupiter is available immediately after the sky becomes dark high in the eastern side of the sky. If we wait until 11 or 11:30 over on the eastern side low on the horizon, we can now begin to see both the planet Saturn and Mars rising up in the east. So as we move on in the coming weeks of this month, those objects will rise higher in the evening as the sky gets darker, so they'll become available earlier.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, time.
Finally this evening, a woman believed to be Pennsylvania's oldest resident has passed away at the age of 113. Irene Cuffoletti died Saturday in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, according to the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. The Gerontology Research Group, which tracks people older than 110 worldwide, said she was Pennsylvania's oldest resident, the fourth oldest in the United States, 16th oldest in the world. Cuffoletti spoke with the ABC Pittsburgh affiliate WTAE on her 110th birthday.
How old?
110.
110? My God. No.
Yeah.
Born in 1903 in Santa Arsenio, Italy, she emigrated to New Kensington, Pennsylvania in 1912. She was preceded in death by her husband and four sons and is survived by one, Julius. She's also survived by 11 grandchildren, 13 great-grandchildren, and 6 great-great-grandchildren. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Philadelphia mosaic artist Isaiah Zager has been well known in the region for decades. A new exhibit focuses on the relationship between him and his wife, Julia. We'll hear about it on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.